Nonsense. A penitentiary is not intended to be a place for coddling and pampering those who have broken the law. Stevenson, chairman of the prison commission, waved a fat hand in the direction of the convict standing at the foot of the table. "This man," he went on, "has learned in some way that the newspapers are gunning for the warden, and he is seizing the opportunity to make a play for sympathy on his own behalf. I'll admit that these tales he tells of brutality toward the prisoners are well told, but I believe that he is stretching the facts. They can't be true. Discipline must be maintained in a place like this, even if it requires harsh measures to do it at times." "There is no call for brutality, however," exclaimed the convict, breaking the rule that prisoners must not speak unless they are spoken to. Then, ignoring the chairman's upraised hand, he went on, "We were treated like beasts here. If a man so much as opens his mouth to ask a civil and necessary question, the reply is a blow. Dropping a knife or fork or spoon at the table is punished by going without the next meal. Men too ill to work are driven to the shops with the butts of guns. Petty infractions of the most trivial rules mean the dark cell and a diet of bread and water. Do you know what the dark cell is? Solitary, they call it here. Hell would be a better name. Steel all around you. Steel walls. Steel door. Steel ceiling. Steel floor. Not a cot to lie upon. Not even a stool to sit upon. Nothing but the bare floor. And darkness. Not a ray of light ever penetrates the dark cell once the door is closed upon you. No air comes to you except through a small ventilator in the roof. And even that has an elbow to keep the light away from you. Is it any wonder that even the most refractory prisoner comes out of there broken? Broken in mind, in body, in spirit. And some of them go insane, stark staring mad, after only a few hours of it. And for what? I spent 2 days in solitary because I collapsed from weakness at my bench in the shoe factory. See this scar?" He pointed to a livid mark over one eye. "A guard did that, with the barrel of his rifle, because I was unable to get up and go back to work when he told me. He knocked me senseless, and when I came to, I was in solitary. Insubordination, they called it. 2 days they kept me in there when I ought to have been in a hospital. 2 days of hell and torture because I was ill. People prate of reforming men in prison. It's the other way around. It makes confirmed criminals of them if they don't go mad first." The chairman wriggled in his seat and cleared his throat impatiently. "We have listened to you for quite a while, my man," he said pompously, "but I, for one, have had enough. A dozen or more prisoners have testified here today, and none of them has made a statement to back up the charges you have made." "And why?" demanded the prisoner. "Because they are afraid to tell the truth. They know that they would be beaten and starved and deprived of their good time on one excuse or another if they even hinted at what they know. You wouldn't believe them anyhow. You don't believe me, yet I probably shall suffer for what I have said here. But that doesn't matter. They can't take any good time away from me. I'm in for life." His voice grew bitter. "And that is one reason I have gone into this thing in detail, for my sake and the sake of others who cannot look forward to ever leaving this place. The law has decreed that we shall live and die here, but the law said nothing about torturing us. This board guaranteed its protection to all who were called upon to testify here," answered the chairman. "It has no desire to whitewash any person in connection with the investigation which is being made, and in order that there might be no reflection upon the manner in which this hearing is conducted, neither the warden, his deputies, nor guards have been permitted to attend. Unless you have tangible evidence to offer us, and can give the names of those who can back up your charges, you may go." "Just a minute." It was the board member nearest the prisoner who interrupted. Then, to the convict, "You said, I believe, that only a few hours in the dark cell often will drive a man insane. Yet you spent 2 days there. You are not insane, are you?" "No, sir." The convict spoke respectfully. "My conscience was clear, and I was able to serve my time there without breaking. But another day or so would have finished me. You testified against me at my trial, didn't you? I hold no grudge against you for that, sir. I give you credit for doing only what you thought was your duty. Your testimony clinched the case against me. Yet I am innocent." The chairman rapped sharply upon the table. I utterly fail to see what all this has to do with the matter under investigation, he protested irritably. We are not trying this man's case. The courts have passed upon that. He is just like all the rest. Any one of them is ready to swear on a stack of Bibles that he is innocent. Let's get on with this investigation. The convict bowed silently and turned toward the door, beyond which the guards were waiting, to conduct him back to his cell. A hand upon his arm detained him. Mr. Chairman, said Blaylock, the member who had questioned the prisoner, I request that this man be permitted to go on with what he was saying. I shall have no more questions to ask. You were saying? He prompted the man beside him. I was saying that I was innocent, resumed the convict. I was about to add that not even a man who was guiltless of wrongdoing would be able to withstand the terrors of solitary for any length of time. You, for instance, are a physician, a man of sterling reputation, against whom no one has ever breathed a word. Yet I doubt that you could endure several hours in the dark cell. If you would only try it, you would know for yourself that I have spoken the truth. Gentlemen, I beg of you to do all in your power to abolish the dark cell. Men can stand just so much without cracking, and if you will dig into the facts, you will find that 9 times out of 10, it is men broken and solitary who are responsible for the outbreaks in prison. That is all. He bowed respectfully and was gone. Clever talker, that fellow, commented the secretary of the commission, breaking the silence. He almost had me believing him. Who is he, Blaylock? You had him summoned, I believe. The physician nodded. I confess it was as much from personal interest in the man as from any hope that he might give valuable evidence here, he said. He surprised me with his outburst. He is a clever talker. Ellis is his name, Martin Ellis, and he comes of a splendid and well-to-do family. University graduate, and quite capable of having carved out a wonderful career. But he was idolized at home and given more money than was good for him. It made him an idler and a young ne'er-do-well. But whatever he did openly, and I never heard of anything seriously wrong until he was convicted of the crime which brought him here. Murder, I suppose? Stevenson, the chairman, was interested in spite of himself. He spoke of being in for life. Yes, killing a girl. Agnes Keller was her name. Poor, but well thought of. Church worker, member of the choir, and so on. It was brought out at the trial, in fact, Ellis told it himself, that he was infatuated with her, and they were together a great deal. Not openly, of course, because old man Ellis, his father, would have pawed up the earth. The affair ended like all these clandestine affairs, especially if the girl is young and pretty and poor. It was the theory of the prosecution that when she discovered her condition, she became frantic and demanded that Ellis marry her, the alternative being that she would go to his father with the story. It was charged that he killed her to avoid making a choice. The evidence against him was purely circumstantial, but the jury held it was conclusive. Ellis admitted on the stand that they often went riding in his motor car at night. One damning fact against him was that he was seen driving, alone and rapidly, along the country lane near where her body was found. He had nothing to back up his claim that he felt ill and went for a drive in an effort to relieve a sick headache. Of course, he denied absolutely that he was responsible for her condition, or that he even knew of it, but the jury was out less than an hour. The only hitch, I learned later, was whether to affix the death penalty or not. He said you were a witness against him. What part did you play? Asked Stevenson. An unwilling one, answered Blaylock quickly. I did not believe that Ellis was guilty then. I'm not convinced of it now. But as the girl's physician, and presumably one of those to whom she would go in her trouble, I was questioned as soon as the coroner had held an autopsy. I admitted that she had confided in me, and that I had agreed that the man responsible should marry her. She did not tell me his name, but my evidence added weight to the theory that Ellis killed her to avoid marrying her. The door to the room swung open, and the warden stood on the threshold. May I come in? He asked. Dinner is almost ready, and I thought I'd better give you warning. He crossed to an empty chair and sat down. We concluded the taking of evidence quite a little while ago, said the chairman. Since then, Dr. Blaylock has been entertaining us with the story of the crime of that fellow Martin Ellis. He was one of the witnesses. Quite unusual. Yes, the sheriff who brought him here told me all about it, answered the warden. He's hard to handle. Had trouble with one of the guards a while back, and we had to discipline him. 2 days in the solitary cell on bread and water, wasn't it? Asked Blaylock. He didn't have any good word for it. The warden flushed. Few of those who taste of it do, he admitted. Too much a matter of being left alone with your thoughts and your conscience. They'll punish you as much as anything can. Well, suppose you take an adjournment and come on to dinner. Will you want to make the regular inspection tour of the prison? Oh, sure, yawned the chairman. Undoubtedly, everything is all right, as usual. But if we admitted it, the newspapers would have something to howl about. He rose, and with the rest of the commission trailing them, followed the warden to the dining room. Well, let's make the inspection and have it over with, Stevenson suggested when the meal was finished. Where do we go first, warden? Through the shops and smaller buildings first, then the cells. That way you'll end up closest to the administration building, and you can go back into conference with the least delay. Uniformed guards stood smartly at attention as the warden piloted the commission through. Trustees ingratiatingly hovered about the party, eager to be of service. Great steel-barred doors swung open at the approach of the commission and clanged noisily behind it. The afternoon sunlight, slanting through the bars, relieved the somberness of the cell blocks and revealed them in their spick and spanness, made ready for the occasion. "Well, everything seems to be okay," said the chairman, as the party again drew near to the offices. "Anyone else got any suggestions?" "Yes, I'd like to see the dark cell," answered the secretary. "I don't recall ever visiting it, and that fellow Ellis interested me. He said it was a pocket edition of Hades. Where is it, warden?" The ward assumed a jocular air. "You'll be disappointed," he warned. "It's down in the basement, where prisoners who want to do so can yell and scream to their heart's content without disturbing anyone. A trifle dark, of course, but if to some it is hell, it is because they choose to make it so. If you really want to see it, come ahead. It's not occupied, however." He did not mention that he had seen to that. With all this uproar about the management of the prison, it wasn't safe to take chances. The commission, he had foreseen, might decide to make a real investigation, and you never could tell in just what condition a man would be in after several hours in solitary. "There you are, gentlemen," he said with a flourish of the hand when a trustee had switched on the lights in the basement. "Not one dark cell, but half a dozen." He stood back as the members of the commission crowded forward and peered into the dark recesses. Over each doorway, a single electric bulb shone weakly, far too weakly for the rays to penetrate into the corners. The solid, bolt-studded doors stood open, formidable and forbidding. "Any of you want to try it?" asked the warden from the background. "Sure, let Blaylock take a whirl at one of them," suggested the secretary. "His conscience ought to be clear enough not to trouble him. Go on, doctor. Try it and let us know how it feels. I'd do it myself, but I don't dare risk my conscience." Blaylock, standing just inside the doorway of one of the cells, turned and for a moment surveyed them in silence. "Your suggestion, of course, was made in jest," he said. "But," a sudden ring came into his voice, "I am going to take you up on it." "No," as a chorus of exclamations came from the others, "my mind is quite made up. Warden, I want this as realistic as possible. You will please provide me with a suit of the regulation convict clothing." "Well, of all the blamed fools," exclaimed the chairman. Then he gave his shoulders a shrug. "Go on and get a zebra suit, warden. I only hope this doesn't get into the papers." A trustee was dispatched for the striped suit. When it had been brought, Blaylock already had removed his outer garments amid the banter of the others. He did not deign to answer them until he had buttoned about him the prison jacket and jammed upon his head the little striped cap. "I guess I'm ready," he said then. "You gentlemen have seen fit to ridicule the experiment I am about to make, but I say to you that I'm doing this in all seriousness. I do not believe that solitary is as bad as Ellis pictured it to us. I am going to find out. Warden, you will please see that conditions here are made exactly like those which surround a prisoner in this place." He whirled upon his heel and strode into the cell. "How long do you want to be left in there?" asked the warden. 15 minutes or so?" Ellis declared his belief that I could not stand it for an hour or two, came the reply from the depths of the cell. Suppose that we make it 2 hours. At the end of that time, you may return and release me, but not a minute before. Very well, number 9982, replied the warden. You are now alone with your conscience. The heavy door clanged shut, and a faint click told Blaylock that the light above the door had been snapped off. Then the sound of footsteps, growing fainter and fainter, the clang of the door leading to the basement. Then, silence. Blaylock was alone. Feeling with his hands, he made his way to a corner of the cell and sat down upon the bare, hard floor. He shut his eyes and set about concentrating his mind upon some subject other than the fact that he was a prisoner, of his own free will, to be sure, but a prisoner nevertheless. He always had prided himself upon the fact that he had the ability to drive from his thoughts at will all topics but the one which he desired. Now, he chose, at random, to begin preparing an outline of a lecture which he was scheduled to deliver within 2 weeks before the convention of medical men. Back home in his study, Blaylock was accustomed to stretching out at length in an easy chair, his feet upon a stool, a pillow beneath his head. Here, his legs were stretched out upon the floor at right angles to his body, held bolt upright by the steel wall at his back. He sought to relieve the strain by keeping his knees in the air, but the floor offered no firm foothold, and his heels slipped. Irritated, Blaylock slid away from the corner and tried lying upon his back, his eyes staring up into the darkness above him. Immediately, that position, too, grew irksome, and he turned over upon first one side, then the other, and finally he got up on his feet and leaned against the wall. Thus, another 15 or 20 minutes passed, he judged. He found that it was impossible to concentrate his thoughts, so he resolved to let them wander. Leaning against the wall speedily proved uncomfortable, and Blaylock began to pace around and around the narrow confines of the cell. 4 paces one way, 2 at right angles, then 4, then 2. It reminded him of a big bear he had once watched in a zoo, striding back and forth behind the bars, but never very far from the door, which shut him off from the outside world and freedom. Suddenly, Blaylock discovered that he had made the circuit so many times in the darkness that he was turned around, that he did not know at which end lay the door to the cell. He began to hunt for it, feeling with his sensitive surgeon's fingers for the place where the door fitted into the wall of the cell. It annoyed him, after making 2 trips around, that he had failed to locate the door. He could tell by counting the corners as he came to them. The door fitted into its casing so well that he could not distinguish it from the grooves where the plates of the cell were joined together. Immediately, it became to him the most important thing in the world to know where lay that door. He thought of sounding the walls to see if at some point they would not give back a different sound and thus tell him what he felt he must know. It was becoming a mania with him now. So gently, he began rapping with his knuckles against the steel, here, there, in one place, then in another. Then he tried it all over with his ear, trained to detect, even without the aid of a stethoscope, the variations in the beating of a human heart, pressed close against the walls. But again he was foiled. Every spot gave forth the same hollow sound. Angered, Blaylock kicked viciously against the insensate steel. Shooting pains in his maltreated toes rewarded him, and with a growl of anguish, he dropped to the floor to nurse the injured members. Then he became aware that his hands were stickily saturated, and he knew, when he discovered that his knuckles were skinned and raw, that it was his own blood. Desperately, he fought to regain his self-control in an effort to force himself to be bland and unruffled when the warden should come to release him, as Blaylock felt sure would be the case in only a few minutes at most. He caught himself listening intently for the footsteps of the warden, or some trustee or guard sent to release him. He strained his ears to catch the faraway clang which would indicate that someone was coming into the basement. But only the hissing sound of his own breath broke the tense silence. Funny, he thought, how very still things could be. It required no very big stretch of the imagination to picture himself as really a recalcitrant prisoner, slapped in solitary to ponder upon his misdeeds. Going further, he recalled a story, which he had read long ago, of a man who found himself to be the only living human being, the others having been wiped out in the flicker of an eyelash by some mysterious force. Why didn't the warden come on and let him out of here? Surely the 2 hours were up, and he was getting tired of it. It would never do, however, to be caught in this frame of mind when he was released. He must emerge smiling and ready to give the lie to that clever talker, Ellis. Once more, he got up and began his circuit of the walls. He felt that he was master of himself again, and it would do no harm to try to solve the puzzle of the door that would not be found. Perhaps the warden had been delayed by some unexpected happening. Oh well, a few minutes longer wouldn't make any difference. Suppose that he were in Ellis's place, in for life. He didn't want to think of Ellis. But somehow the face of the lifer kept obtruding itself, his face and his words. What was it that Ellis had said? You, for instance, are a physician, a man of sterling reputation, against whom no one ever breathed a word. Yet I doubt if you could endure several hours in the dark cell. And the warden had added that in the dark cell, a man was alone with his conscience. Damn that warden. Where was he anyhow? Blaylock began to dislike him. Perhaps there was something in those stories of brutality which the newspapers had printed after all. Dislike for the warden began to give way to hate. Blaylock wondered if the warden and that fat, pompous little Stevenson, chairman of the commission, hadn't got their heads together and decided it would be a good joke to let him stay in there a great deal longer than he had ordered. He would show them, once he got out, that he didn't relish that kind of a joke, that he wasn't a man to be trifled with. Thus another hour passed, as he reckoned it, and his anger and passion got the best of him. He kicked the walls and hammered upon them with his clenched fists, insensible to the fact that he was injuring himself. Then came fear. Fear that he had been forgotten. Suppose that there had been an outbreak in the prison, that the convicts were in control. Would they release him? Might they not wreak their vengeance upon him in the absence of another victim? He began to call, moderately at first and pausing often to listen for some response, then louder and louder until he was screaming without cessation. He cursed and swore, pleaded and cajoled, threatened and sought to bribe by turns, demanding only that he be taken from this terrible place. He was dead to the fact that it was impossible for anyone to hear him, that only the reverberation of his own voice, thunderous in that narrow place, answered him. Beating down from the ceiling, thrown up from the floor, cast back into his teeth by the walls, the noise of his own making overwhelmed him, crushed him. Stark terror held him in its icy grip now. His thoughts pounded through his brain like water in a mill race. The perspiration fell from him in rivulets as he hammered and smashed at the walls. His brain was afire. He began to realize that what Ellis had said very easily could be true. Men did go mad in this place. Why, he was going mad himself, mad from the torture his body was undergoing, mad from being alone with his own thoughts. There were more lucid moments when reason desperately sought to assert itself. Blaylock's cries became less violent, and, moaning and sobbing softly, he began all over again that endless circuit of the cell in search of the door. Failing, he raved again and staggered from wall to wall, or leaped madly toward the ceiling, as if, by some miracle, escape might lie in that direction. Exhausted at last, he sank to the floor, poignantly conscious that interminable nights and days were passing over his head, and that thirst and hunger, keen and excruciating, held him in their grasp. At intervals, strength would come back to him, strength backed by indomitable willpower that sent him lunging to his feet to renew his battering at the walls, his frenzied shouts and screeches, in just one more effort to make himself heard. His knuckles were broken and bleeding, his lips cracked and swollen. His voice came out shrilly from his dry and racked throat. His body and legs were succumbing to a great weariness that would not be denied. Came the time at last when his own voice no longer dinned into his ears, when his legs refused to obey the will that commanded them to hoist him upon his feet, when he no longer could lift his hands. His spirit was broken at last, and he gave up the struggle and sank back upon the floor. And all around him, the darkness shut down, the darkness and the silence. Then the door was thrown open, and framed in silhouette against the light beyond, stood the warden. "Got enough, doctor?" he called out cheerily. "Your 2 hours are up. Why don't you answer me? Dr. Blaylock, what's wrong, man?" He peered into the cell in a vain endeavor to force his eyes to penetrate the darkness. Failing, he fumbled in his clothes for a match, and with hands that shook, scratched it against the door. Then his face went white as a sheet. He staggered where he stood, and the match burned down to the flesh of his hands and scorched it. For in the far corner, he had perceived, flat upon its back, a haggard, blood-stained, white-haired thing that winked and blinked at him with vacant eyes and muttered and gibbered incoherently. Reason came back to Blaylock one day many weeks later. He opened his eyes with the light of understanding in them, and they told him from his surroundings that he was in a hospital. Outside, the sun was shining brightly, and in a little park just beyond, birds were singing, and the breeze brought him the sound of children at play. "Awake at last, are you?" asked the white-capped nurse who came into the room just then. "Yes," said Blaylock in a rasping whisper. He did not know it then, but the calm, soothing voice he had once boasted was his best asset in a sick room was gone forever. The terrific strain to which he had put his vocal cords and his paroxysms in the dark cell had shattered them. "You're doing splendidly," the nurse assured him brightly. "You've been seriously ill, but you're recovering rapidly now." "No," said Blaylock positively, as one who knows. "I shall never get well. Give me a mirror, please." "I don't believe there's one handy," she evaded, loath to let him see the havoc in his face. But he insisted. "Please," he begged. "I am prepared, and I do not think I will be overcome. I will be brave." Reluctantly, then, she started to place the silvered glass in his hand. As he reached out to take it, he stopped, his hand halfway. The hand he was accustomed to see, with its tapering fingers and well-kept nails, the hand that so deftly had performed delicate operations, was gone. Instead, was a slim, claw-like thing, with distorted knuckles and joints. Blaylock finally extended it, took the mirror, and slowly but steadily brought it into line with his eyes. He had expected some changes, but not the sight that greeted him. The black, wavy hair had given place to locks of snowy white. His face was drawn and wrinkled, and lackluster eyes stared back at him from cavernous sockets. Long he gazed at this apparition, then silently he let the mirror fall upon the cover and closed his eyes. "Don't take it so hard, doctor," begged the nurse. "You've been through a harrowing experience, and your face shows it now. But in a short time..." The lie did not come easily, and her tongue faltered. "Never mind that," whispered Blaylock. "It doesn't matter now. Send for Stevenson, please." The chairman of the prison commission came without delay. Compelling himself to conceal the repulsion he felt at the sight of the broken man upon the bed, he bustled in with forced pleasantries. "Stevenson," said Blaylock, when finally the other had taken a chair and the nurse had withdrawn, "I have something to tell you. That day I went into the dark cell..." "Now, now, old man," soothed Stevenson, laying a restraining hand upon the other's arm. "Don't let's talk about that. We abolished it that very day. Why bring up that awful experience of yours? No one knows about it but the commission, the warden, and your doctor and nurse here. We all are pledged not to talk about it, and the newspapers didn't have a line except that you were taken ill. Let the past take care of itself, Blaylock, old man, and let us talk of other things." A flash of the old willpower shone in the sick man's eyes. "No," he said firmly. "No, Stevenson, the past cannot take care of itself. Bend closer, Stevenson. I must tell you something, and it seems I'm not strong enough yet to talk out loud. That day I so boastfully demanded that I be locked up in solitary, I thought I knew myself and my willpower. I believed that I had such control over my mind and my body that I could defy any torture man might devise without quailing, despite the knowledge that my conscience was not the lily-white thing I had led others to believe it was. For Stevenson, my conscience was black as hell. It held the knowledge of a great sin on my part, a huge wrong that had been done to another. But I had stifled it by my willpower until I believed it a thing that was dead, that could never throw off the bondage to which I had doomed it, and arise and accuse me. It was to prove that I was superior to it, that I deliberately chose to be locked up with it, where, alone with my thoughts, I could prove myself the master once and for all. For Martin Ellis had shaken my confidence. Where before I had been certain, I was doubtful. I wanted to prove him a liar, and at the same time satisfy myself that I was a free man, and not the galley slave of that thing which we call a guilty conscience. In that cell, that conscience which I believed I had killed, rose up to show me it had but been sleeping. Under other conditions, it might have slept on indefinitely. In there, it overwhelmed me with a sense of its power, and made me feel that I was about to meet my God without even so much as a veil behind which to hide my guilty thoughts. No matter which way I turned, I saw an accusing finger pointing at me out of the darkness, and the solitude was shattered by a voice which cried out that those who sin must pay and pay until the slate is wiped clean. And I had sinned, but I had not paid. Conscience is a terrible thing once it is aroused, Stevenson. It is living, vibrant, and it lashes and scourges until it has exacted its toll. That was what it did to me, there in the darkness, alone and at its mercy, and with no chance to escape. And in my agony and fear, I cursed the God who had created me and saddled me with this thing. I learned my lesson, though, before I was through. I, who had presumed to piece my own puny will above the great eternal will, I, who had dared to believe that the great order of things, the plan by which we all must live and die, must make an exception of me, learned that I was wrong. Martin Ellis is innocent, Stevenson, and I trust to you to see that justice is done. He did not kill Agnes Keller, and I knew it. And I stood by and let him be convicted. More, I took the stand against him and helped make that conviction certain. I told only the truth in my testimony. But I did not tell all I knew, and what I omitted would have saved Ellis. I did not want to testify at all, but the prosecution refused to let me take advantage of the confidential relation which is supposed to exist between physician and patient. The state was right in its theory that the man who strangled Agnes Keller did so because he was responsible for her condition and did not wish to marry her. She came to me in my study on the night she met her death, and told me she had discovered she was about to become a mother. She refused to take any steps I suggested, and she said that her child, when it was born, must have the legal right to bear the name of its father. And that very night she was lured into an automobile with the promise that the man who was to blame would take her to a nearby town and make her his wife. But on that lonely country road, he turned upon her and killed her with his bare hands. And how do I know these things? Because, Stevenson, I was the man responsible for her condition, and it was I who killed her. If every one of the 60 guards and officials at the Granite River Prison had been asked for the name of the most popular guard on the force, there would have been 60 answers, Asa Shores. If each of the 1,500 convicts in the prison had been asked which guard was the most disliked by the convicts, 1,500 answers would have been the same, Asa Shores. If some curious person had asked of each convict and each guard, who is considered the most desperate, the hardest, the shrewdest criminal in the prison? The answer would have been unanimous. Malcolm Hulsey, the lifer. True, it does not seem reasonable that Asa Shores should be liked by every guard and official, and disliked by every convict. To those not familiar with the duties of prison guards, it would seem that Asa Shores' method of handling the convicts, if disapproved of by 1,500 convicts, would surely be disapproved of by at least one of the 60 guards. But the explanation is simple. Asa Shores' great-great-grandfather had followed the prisons as mariners follow the seas. Then Asa's grandfather took up the work and followed it, with an iron hand and inflexible will, until one day a cell-made knife in the hands of a longtime con entered his back at a point where his suspenders crossed, deviating enough to the left to pierce his heart. Came next Asa Shores' father, who went down in attempting to quell the famous Stromberg break of 1895. Asa, therefore, his prison methods impelled perhaps by heredity, looked upon every wearer of gray behind the walls as a convict, nothing more, nothing less. He neither abused nor favored any convict. A one-year man was to Asa a convict and no better than the man who was serving a life sentence. The crime for which any convict was sent up was of little moment to Asa. Neither did he bother about who among the inmates was considered desperate. The fact that a man wore prison gray was sufficient, whether he be a six-month sneak thief or a 99-year murderer. When Asa shot and killed Richard Mutt Allison, when the latter attempted to escape, the warden had said, "There was really no need of killing that half-witted short-termer, Asa. He was doing only a year and was perfectly harmless. A shot in the leg or foot would have been better." And Asa's reply had been, "I had no idea who the man was, though I have seen him dozens of times, and I did not know how long he was doing. But it would have made no difference if I had known. He was a convict, sir, and he was attempting to escape. If he was only half-witted, as you say, he should have been in the insane asylum, not in the penitentiary." So that was that. If Asa ever gave a convict a smile, it had never been recorded. It is a known fact that he was never seen to frown upon a convict. He was, in short, the smileless, unyielding personification of duty, and every convict hated him for what he was. When Asa shot, he shot to kill, and he never missed. Four little white crosses on the bleak hillside near the prison proclaimed his flawless marksmanship. Why was this big, sandy-haired, steel-blue-eyed, middle-aged Asa Shores liked by his brother guards? There were many reasons why. It was as if Asa's unnatural, cold, vigilant, unfeeling attitude toward the convicts was offset each day when he came off duty by a healthy, wholesome desire to drop duty as a workhorse sheds an irritating harness. He was the life of the guards' quarters, a big, good-natured, playful fellow who thoroughly enjoyed a practical joke, whether he be the victim of the joke or the instigator. If he had a temper, he had never allowed it to come to the surface. He excelled in all sports in the gymnasium, and somewhere, somehow, he found more funny stories than any other man on the force. The trite old saying that he would give a friend the shirt off his back fitted him like a new kid glove. He gave freely to his friends, and in giving, seemed to find real joy. After 12 years' service on the guard line, Asa was still an ordinary wall guard. This would seem discouraging to many, but not so to Asa. It was not generally known that he drew a larger salary than did the other wall guards. He was an excellent wall guard. Hence, he was kept on the wall, while newer men on the force were promoted to better positions. But Asa drew the salary of a shift captain, and was therefore content. He did not even seem to mind when he was taken from comfortable Tower No. 1, morning shift, and detailed permanently to Tower No. 3, on the graveyard shift, at night from 8 p.m. to 4 a.m. This change was deemed necessary for several reasons. First, because Asa positively refused to discriminate between short-termers and long-termers, or desperate men and harmless nuts, when using his rifle to stop a break or the attempt of a single convict to escape. The men being locked in their cells at night, Asa, as a night guard, would have little opportunity to practice rifle shooting with a running convict as the target. Another reason for detailing him to Tower No. 3 was because trouble was expected some night at that point in the yard, and with Surefire Asa on the job, the officials felt that any attempt of the convicts to escape would be promptly frustrated. One of Asa's wholesome habits, when no convicts were near him, was singing. It was not singing, really, but Asa thought it was, and he shortened the long, lonesome hours at night on Tower No. 3 with songs. Song, rather, because he knew and sang but one. It was not a late or popular song, and as Asa sang it, it sounded like the frogs that croak in the marshes at night. "When I die and am buried deep, I'll return at night to take a peep at those who hated me. I'll haunt their homes and spoil their sleep. Chill their blood, the skin will creep on those who hated me." Not a pretty song, nor did it make cheerful those guards who passed near Tower No. 3 while making the night rounds. But Asa loved that song. It was while the wall was being extended another 200 feet to make room within the enclosure for a new cell house that Asa shot the lifer, Malcolm Halsey. The end wall, extending from tower number 3 to tower number 4, had been torn down and the stones moved 200 feet farther south to be used on the new wall. A temporary barbed wire fence had been erected about the area in which the convicts worked on the new wall. Extra armed guards were stationed at intervals of 50 feet outside the enclosure to guard the working convicts. Malcolm Halsey had successfully feigned illness one day and was allowed to remain in his cell. Cell house guards had seen him lying in his bunk, only the top of his head showing above the blankets. At lockup time, the cell house guards making the count saw a foot protruding from under the blankets in Halsey's bunk and what they believed to be the top of his head showing at the head of the bed. At 10:15 that night, the eagle-eyed Asa Shores, on tower number 3, saw a dark figure slip under the lower wire of the temporary fence and run. Asa fired once and saw the man fall. Then Asa, to comply with the prison rules, yelled, "Halt!" The command, of course, was needless, Halsey having halted abruptly when a 30-30 rifle ball plowed through his shoulder. After the convict had been carried to the hospital, his cell was opened by the curious guards. A cleverly carved wooden foot protruded from under the blankets at the foot of the bed. Several bags of old clothing reposed under the blankets, and a thatch of black horsehair showed at the head of the bed. Before Halsey left the hospital, the new wall was completed. Tower number 4, across from tower number 3, had been torn down, and a new tower number 4, built on the new corner of the wall, 200 feet farther south. On the other corner, across from new tower number 4, was new tower number 3. Old tower number 3 was left standing until further orders. Asa Shores remained on the graveyard shift on old tower number 3. While off duty one day, Asa, prowling about inside the walls, met Malcolm Halsey. The lifer was still a bit pale and worn from the gunshot wound. "One thing I'd like to have you explain, Mr. Shores," said Halsey. "You plugged me in the shoulder, then yelled, 'Halt!' Why didn't you command me to stop before firing?" "Well, it was this way, Halsey," Asa replied, unsmiling and looking the convict squarely in the eye. "I aimed at the spot where I calculated your heart ought to be, but the light was poor and I had to shoot quick. I naturally supposed you were dead when I commanded you to halt, and believing you dead, I could see no reason for being in a hurry with the command. Sorry I bungled the job that way, but my intentions were good." "But," the scowling lifer persisted, "you haven't told me yet why you shot before commanding me to halt." "Oh, that?" Asa drawled with a deprecatory shrug of his massive shoulders. "That is merely a matter of form with me. I very often, after shooting a convict, yell halt sometime the next day or week. Besides, if you had a nice chance to bump me off, you wouldn't say, 'Beware, Mr. Shores, I'm about to kill you.'" For a half minute, convict and keeper gazed into each other's eyes. "I get you," Halsey finally said, "and I guess you're right. I have an idea, though, that my turn comes next, Mr. Shores, and there'll be no preliminary command or argument." "Fair enough, Halsey," Asa replied as he turned away. At last, the big new cell house was completed. Asa wondered whether he would be left on old tower number 3. It had been decided, he knew, that the old tower would be left on the wall, but perhaps not used. To celebrate the completion of the new building, the warden declared a holiday and issued orders that all the inmates be given the privilege of the yard that day. There was to be wrestling, boxing, foot racing, and other sports. Asa Shore's sleeping quarters was a low-ceilinged room on the ground floor in one of the towers of the old cell house. Asa had been warned a number of times that his room was not a safe place to sleep in the daytime. Convicts in the yard could enter the room at any time during the day, without being seen by the yard guards or wall guards. Though the one door to the room was thick and heavy, Asa seldom, if ever, locked it. Asa had risen in the afternoon, complaining to himself about the noise being made by the convicts in the yard. His peevishness vanished, however, after a cold wash, and he sang as he stood looking out one of the windows and brushing his hair. "When I die and am buried deep, I'll return at night to take a peep at those who hated me. I'll haunt their homes and spoil their sleep. Chill their blood, the skin will creep. On those who... Asa's song ended then, ended in a horrible gurgle. A trustee found him an hour later, lying in a pool of blood near the open window. His throat had been cut by a sharp instrument in the hand of a person unknown. Halsey the lifer was questioned, of course, but there was absolutely nothing to indicate that it was he who committed the murder. The guards looked sadly upon all that remained of Asa Shores and said to each other in hushed voices, "It had to come. Asa was too good a convict guard not to be murdered." And though the prison stool pigeons kept their ears and eyes opened, though each guard became a detective, the murder of Asa Shores remained a mystery. Old Tower Number 3 was closed and the doors locked. There was no immediate use for it, but the warden was contemplating the advisability of having another guard's entrance gate cut through the wall under the tower. In this case, of course, the tower would be used again. Night Captain Jesse Dunlap sat alone in the guard's lookout, inside the walls, at 1 o'clock on the morning following the murder of Asa Shores. Bill Wilton, the night yard guard, was making his round about the buildings in the yard. Captain Dunlap lazily watched the brass indicators on the report board before him. The indicator for Tower Number 1 made a half turn to the left, and a small bell on the board rang. The captain lifted the receiver from the telephone at his elbow and received the report. Tower Number 1, Anderson on duty, all okay. Dunlap merely grunted a response and replaced the receiver on the hook. Presently, the indicator for Tower Number 2 turned to the left, the bell tinkled, and Dunlap again took the receiver from the hook. Tower Number 2, Briggs on duty, all okay, came the report over the wire. Then came new Tower Number 3, next Tower Number 4. From the three outside guard posts came the reports, and one from the cell house, each guard turning in his post number, his name, and the usual okay. All the indicators on the board, except that for old Tower Number 3, were now turned. Captain Dunlap relaxed in his chair, sighed heavily, and lit his pipe. Lazily, his eyes wandered back to the indicator board. The unturned indicator for Old Tower Number 3 held his gaze, and utter sadness gripped him for a moment. Night after night, promptly on the hour, he had seen the indicator for Old Tower Number 3 flip jauntily to the left, and had heard the tinkle of a little bell on the board. It had always seemed to him that the indicator for Asa Shore's tower turned with more pep than the other indicators, that the bell had tinkled more cheerily, that good old Asa Shore's report carried a note of cheerfulness that lightened the lonesome watches of the night. Now the old tower was cold, even as poor old Asa was cold. The doors were locked and barred. Never again, thought Dunlap, would be heard Asa Shore's familiar song on the quiet night air. What were the words to that song? When I am dead and buried deep, I'll return at night to take a peep at those who hated... Captain Dunlap suddenly sat erect in his chair. The pipe fell from his lips and clattered on the floor, as his lower jaw dropped and his eyes opened wide to stare at the indicator board. The indicator for Old Tower Number 3 was moving. Moving, not with a quick turn to the left, but in a hesitant, jerky way that caused the root of every hair on Captain Dunlap's head to tingle. Never before had the captain seen an indicator behave like that. In fact, the indicator system was designed and constructed in such a way that being controlled by electric contacts, the various indicators would snap into position when a push button in each tower was pressed by the guard on duty in that tower. In short, an indicator, in accordance with all the rules of electricity as applied to the system, must remain stationary or jerk to the left when the button in the tower was pressed. But here was indicator for Old Tower Number 3, wavering, trembling to the left, only to fall back repeatedly to a vertical position. Then again, jerkily, hesitantly to the left, as if a vagrant soul strove to brush aside the veil that banished it from the living. Captain Dunlap sat rigid and watched the uncanny movements of the bright brass indicator. Vague, fleeting, chaotic thoughts of crossed wires, practical jokers, wandering souls tumbled one after another through his brain. If only the bell would not tinkle. If it did ring, Well, death then, though it had taken away what was mortal of Asa Shores, had not conquered his eternal vigilance and strict attention to duty. Farther to the left wavered the indicator, hesitantly, uncertainly. The bell rang. A weak, slow ring it was, that sounded strange and unnatural in the deathlike silence of the dimly lighted lookout. Captain Dunlap was a brave man. He had smilingly faced death a dozen times in Granite River Prison. But always his danger was known to be from living, breathing men. Abject terror gripped him now, a nameless terror that seemed to freeze the blood in his veins, contract every muscle and nerve of his body, smother his heart. But even then, reasoning struggled for recognition in his mind. What if it were a part of Asa Shores, a part of him that remained on Earth to defy death and carry on? Hadn't Asa always been Captain Dunlap's friend? Why should he fear the spirit of a friend? Dunlap reached forth a trembling hand, took the receiver from the hook, and slowly, reluctantly, placed it to his ear. How he wished, hoped, prayed that no voice would come over the wire. But it did come, preceded by a faint whispering sound. A long pause, then weakly, almost inaudibly, as if the message came from a million miles away. Another pause, a jumble of meaningless words, then a chuckle. God. Asa's familiar chuckle. A light laugh, a sharp buzzing sound, a sigh, the faint tinkle of a bell, then silence. Dunlap heard no click of a receiver being replaced on a hook. The line was apparently still open. Still holding the receiver to his ear, the captain moistened his dry lips with the tip of his tongue. His free hand went involuntarily to his forehead in a vague, uncertain gesture and came away damp with perspiration. Must he answer that ghost call? Must he speak to that thing that held the line? When he at last spoke, his voice was husky, a strange voice even to him. Who did it, Asa? If you are dead, if this is you, Asa, tell me, who did it? Again that queer, unfamiliar buzzing sound. Then, from Old Tower Number 3, or from beyond the grave, perhaps, came a faint, whispering, uncertain voice. The voice ended in a gurgle. Dunlap replaced the receiver on the hook, and as he did so, his eyes rested on the indicator board, and he gasped sharply, for the indicator for Old Tower Number 3 went wavering, trembling back to a vertical position on the time dial. This unheard-of behavior of the indicator was the deepest mystery of all. The indicators, each controlled independently of the others by push buttons in each tower, were constructed mechanically to turn only from the right to left. The indicator for Old Tower Number 3 had turned back from left to right. Captain Dunlap made no effort to solve the mystery. Old Tower Number 3 was securely locked and could not be approached except by crossing over the wall from New Tower Number 3 on the southeast corner of the wall, or from Tower Number 2 on the northeast corner of the wall. Dunlap himself had closed and locked the doors and windows to the tower. There was but one key to the tower doors, and that key was in Dunlap's pocket. Unlike the other towers, Old Tower Number 3 could not be entered from the ground outside the wall. It was built solidly of stone from the ground up, and the only entrances were the two doors communicating with the top of the wall on either side of the tower. Besides, strict orders had been given that no one enter the tower unless ordered there by a shift captain. And two, in the glare of the arc lights near the wall, it would be impossible for anyone to cross the wall to the tower without being seen by the other wall guards. Could the mysterious report have come from one of the other wall towers? Impossible for this reason. When the push button in one of the wall towers, say that in Old Tower Number 3, was pressed by the man on duty there, the indicator on the board in the captain's lockout turned to the left a quarter turn on the time dial, the small bell on the board rang, and all telephone connections with the other towers were automatically cut off until the captain had replaced the telephone receiver on the hook after receiving the report from Old Tower No. 3. Dunlap said nothing to Bill Wilton when the latter returned to the yard lookout after making his round in the yard. It would be best, he reasoned, to say nothing to anybody about the mysterious call. They would only laugh at him if he told them about it. If the indicator had not returned to a vertical position on the time dial, he would have some proof on which to base his wild story of the ghost call. But the indicator had, before his own eyes, returned to its former position after the call. An hour later, at 2 a.m., Dunlap fearfully watched the indicator for Old Tower No. 3. Reports from all other posts had been received. Then, just once, the indicator trembled uncertainly, made almost a quarter turn to the left, and snapped back to a vertical position. At 3 o'clock, it did not move, nor did it at 4 o'clock. A week passed. Not a tremor disturbed the ghost tower indicator. Then, one morning at 1:30, an unearthly, piercing scream in the cell house awakened half the men in the building and sent the cell house guard scurrying down to cell 21 on the corridor, for it was from this cell that the blood-chilling scream had come. The bloodless, perspiration-dampened face of Malcolm Hulsey, the lifer, was pressed against the bars of the cell door when the guard arrived. The convict's great hands grasped the bars, and his 250-pound bulk, clad only in a regulation undershirt, twitched, started, and trembled from head to foot. A horrible fear distended his eyes, his teeth clicked together, and the muscles of his face worked spasmodically. "Sick, Hulsey?" the guard demanded, hardened to such nerve-shattering outbursts in a building full of tortured souls. I saw, Hulsey began, his teeth chattering and rendering speech well-nigh impossible. "I saw... Mr. Hill, please give me a cellmate. Now, tonight. I'm a sick man, Mr. Hill. Nerves all shot to pieces, I guess. Can I have a cellmate to talk to, Mr. Hill?" "What did you see?" the guard asked. "He was standing right where you are now," Hulsey whispered hoarsely. "Pointing his fingers at me, he was, when I opened my eyes and saw him. Smiling, too. A violent shudder. "I could see through him, Mr. Hill. Could see the bars on that window beyond him." "Who? See who?" the guard interrupted. Hulsey seemed to realize then that he was talking too much, that he was not conducting himself as the hardest convict in the prison should. "Why," he stammered, I thought I saw an old pal of mine. He's been dead a long time. Nerves, I guess. Thinking too much about my old pal in the good old days. Nightmare, I guess." "Yeah, nightmare is right," the unsympathetic guard growled. "But don't let another blat like that out of you, or we'll throw you out into the padded cell. Got the whole wing stirred up. Get to bed now and forget that good old pal of yours." "If only I could," Hulsey whispered huskily to himself as he got back into the bunk. 2 weeks passed. There were no more outbursts from cell 21. The ghost tower on the wall was silent, cold. Then, at 2 o'clock one morning, Captain Dunlap saw the indicator move. It sickened him, made him wish ardently that he was 1,000 miles from Granite River Prison. The indicator moved slowly, hesitantly, to the left, and the bell tinkled weakly. The captain placed the receiver to his ear, but no sound came. The line was dead. The indicator fell back to its original position as the captain replaced the receiver on the hook. A few minutes later, the yard guard entered the lookout. Bill Wilton, the regular yard guard on the graveyard shift, was away on leave, and the substitute guard was new at the position. "Didn't I understand you to say, Mr. Dunlap," the new guard said, "that there was no one on Old Tower No. 3? "You sure did," Dunlap answered. The guard pulled his left ear and looked puzzled. "Funny," he finally remarked. "I was sure I heard somebody in that tower, singing soft and low-like, when I passed under it a few minutes ago." "What was he singing?" the captain asked, bending forward and fixing a penetrating gaze on the recent arrival at the prison. "Let me see now," said the guard meditatively. "Couldn't make out much of the song. Something about when I die in the ocean deep. No, that wasn't it. When I die and am buried deep, that's it. Then there was something in it about this dead guy coming back to haunt people, and a lot of bunk like that." I see, said Dunlap as he eased himself out of the chair. I'm going up and have a look around in the tower. You stay in here until I return. Dunlap went outside the walls and up through New Tower Number 3, where he questioned Guard Jim Humphrey. Humphrey had not seen or heard anything unusual in or about Old Tower Number 3. Captain Dunlap, as he walked over the wall toward the Ghost Tower, admitted frankly to himself that he was scared stiff. Pausing at the door, he glanced nervously through the window. The yard lights lit up the interior of the tower sufficiently to assure him that no one, or thing, was inside. He unlocked the door and entered. With a flashlight, he thoroughly examined the telephone. Dust had settled on the instrument. The receiver and the transmitter had apparently not been touched since Asa Shores left the tower. Dust had settled on the doorknobs inside. That the knobs had not been touched since Shores' death was obvious. The one chair, the windowsills, the small washstand and washbasin, all were covered with a thin, undisturbed film of fine dust. There, on the telephone battery box, reposed Asa's old corncob pipe, and near it, a small box of matches. The window latches were just as Dunlap had left them when he closed and securely locked the tower a month before. It was a puzzled and nervous prison official that left the tower, relocked the doors, and returned to the inside lookout. The next day, Malcolm Halsey, the lifer, was admitted to the hospital. The doctor's diagnosis was nervous breakdown. But Halsey, though his nerves were all shot to pieces, was still capable of shrewd plotting. His admittance to the hospital had been hastened by a diet of soap. Halsey was so anxious to get far away from Granite River Prison, and was so certain of his ability to do so if he could only be admitted to the hospital, that he had resorted to the old but effective expedient of soap eating. Soap, taken internally in small doses, will produce various baffling and apparently serious physiological changes in the body. Halsey looked and felt sick, but he was not dangerously ill. For many months, Malcolm Halsey had been watching closely the movements of the night guards. During his stay in the hospital, while recovering from the gunshot wound in his shoulder, he had doped out a possible means of escape, and he was on the point of making the attempt when the doctor pronounced him sufficiently recovered to be returned to the cell house. The lifer's plan of escape was simply this. At midnight, while Captain Dunlap and his crew were on duty, the yard guard made his round, counted the patients in the hospital, and left the yard through the guard's gate to eat his lunch in the guard's dining room outside the walls. When the yard guard returned to the inside lookout, he carried with him a hot lunch for Captain Dunlap. In counting the men in the hospital, the yard guard did not, as a rule, enter the building. He merely turned on the lights in one large ward and looked through the window. The convict hospital nurse on night duty stood ready, and when the lights were turned on, proceeded from bed to bed and partly uncovered each patient so that the yard guard outside could see and count them. There were several factors in Halsey's favor now, one being that a new substitute guard was on duty over the guard's entrance gate during the absence of the regular guard who was away on vacation. There was only one patient in the hospital besides Halsey. The yard guard must be lured into the hospital, overpowered, his uniform stripped from him. Then Halsey, garbed in the uniform, would attempt to deceive the guard at the gate and be given the keys. At 15 minutes to midnight on Halsey's first day in the hospital, the lifer quietly rose from his bed while the white-clad convict nurse's back was turned. 3 minutes later, the unsuspecting nurse had been neatly laid out from a well-directed blow behind the ear, bound with sheets, gagged, stripped of his white suit, and tenderly tucked in the bed recently occupied by Mr. Malcolm Halsey. The other patient, a feeble old convict, was gagged and tied down in his bed with sheets. Halsey then donned the nurse's white suit, and after arranging the nurse and the old convict in their beds so that they appeared to be sleeping peacefully, the lifer lay face down on the floor and awaited developments. At 12 o'clock, the new guard appeared at the hospital window and switched on the lights. Having counted the men in the hospital every hour since 8 o'clock, the guard intended now to give the patients a hasty glance and proceed to the gate. There were his two patients, apparently sleeping peacefully. But where was the nurse? Halsey's heart pounded like a riveting hammer as he lay sprawled on the floor. Would the ruse work? Would the guard enter the hospital to investigate, or would he report to Captain Dunlap when he saw the white-clad figure on the floor? The guard's eyes then rested on the man on the floor. "Huh," he exclaimed. "Funny place for Nursie to be sleeping." But the nurse's sprawled form did not indicate slumber. The guard was puzzled. Perhaps the nurse had fainted or fallen and hurt himself. The guard tapped on the window with a key. No answer, no movement of nurse or patients. Then the unsuspecting screw unlocked the door and entered. An older guard would have reported to the captain. He was in the act of bending over to turn the pseudo-nurse upon his back when his ankles were suddenly seized and his feet jerked from underneath him. The guard's head struck an iron bedstead as he fell, thus relieving Halsey of the unpleasant job of beating him into unconsciousness. Several minutes later, the lifer, wearing the guard's uniform, boldly approached the gate. "What's on the menu tonight, Frank?" Halsey casually asked, pulling his hat further down over his eyes. "Same old thing, hash," the gate guard answered as he lowered the keys. Though the suspense, anxiety, and uncertainty were terrible, Halsey whistled calmly as he unlocked the first gate. The large bull lock on the outside gate was not so easily unlocked. Halsey fumbled, his hands shook, in spite of all he could do to keep it up, wheezed and went off key, then died in a discordant wail. "Say," the gate guard suddenly blurted, "look up here. By cracky, your actions don't look good to me." Halsey did not look up. He gave the key another frantic twist, and the lock opened. In that short space of time, the wall guard had raced into the lookout and seized a shotgun. As he stepped to the door of the lookout, a dark figure disappeared around the corner of a building 20 feet from the gate. A moment later, the alarm in the guard's quarters rang frantically, and a dozen sleepy-eyed men tumbled from their beds, slipped on shoes and trousers, and ran out into the yard. The gate guard can only tell where he last saw the escaping convict. To capture the man on such a dark night seemed hopeless, considering, too, that the fleeing man had a 7-minute start. However, the half-dressed guard scattered and made for the heavy willow thicket several hundred yards beyond the spot where the convict was last seen. For 5 minutes after the pursuing guards disappeared in the darkness, silence reigned over the prison. Then, from a distant point in the dark thicket, a hair-raising, half-animal, half-human shriek of mortal terror shattered the stillness of the night and echoed and re-echoed about the high prison walls. White-faced guards, temporarily unnerved by that fearful wail, crashed through the brush, their flashlights playing about like the eyes of speeding demons. Then they found Malcolm Halsey, the lifer, groveling face down in the mud of a little creek bank, hands clutching at empty air, great spasms of maniacal terror passing through his body, the one-time terror of the prison muttered insane, incoherent things. Two guards pulled him to his knees. Others turned flashlights on his face, a face such as is seen in horrible nightmares, a ghastly face, partly covered with black mud. The eyes were wide, protruding, glassy. "See, see," the convict rasped hoarsely, pointing a mud-smeared hand at a dense black nook in the thicket. "See, he stands there and points at me and laughs. It's Asa Shores. He's been in my cell every night for weeks, laughing at me. He sang a death song to me. Always sang, always laughed. Wouldn't let me sleep. He's coming toward me. Stop him, please." Then another horrible shriek, a shudder, a gasp, and the guards dropped the lifeless form of Malcolm Halsey in the mud. By some queer whim of fate, the speechless guards involuntarily switched off their flashlights. Utter darkness, utter silence enveloped them. Then a faint sound was heard. "Listen," came the hoarse voice of Guard Jerry Clark. "Do you hear it?" Very little of it could be heard. It was a faint sound, and growing fainter. Then it was gone, and all was still again.